On the last issue of our program, Dr. Roy Herbst and Dr. Ed Kim from MD Anderson Cancer Center reacted to cases presented from four community-based medical oncologists, and I asked Dr. Kim to further elaborate on clinical research in lung cancer currently ongoing at the Houston-based Cancer Center. And Dr. Kim began by commenting on a first-line trial evaluating bevacizumab with chemotherapy.
Currently, right now, Avastin is a very popular drug. It is probably going to receive approval this year for non-small cell lung cancer in the first-line setting. It is already approved for colorectal cancer and probably will also be approved for breast cancer this year as well. The study that we are conducting at MD Anderson in combination with chemotherapy includes a carboplatin, taxotere, and Avastin trial for first-line non-small cell lung cancer patients. This trial will supplement any of the data that comes from the ECOG trial to show feasibility with other platinum-based doublets.
Can you talk more about the ECOG trial and also your study in terms of how many patients you're going to be accruing and what you're going to look at?
Right. So the ECOG 4599 trial was a two-arm randomized trial of carboplatin and paclitaxel with or without Avastin. You were allowed to take chemotherapy up to six cycles, and then on the Avastin arm, you took it concurrent with chemotherapy, and then you took maintenance Avastin after completing six cycles. There were a little over 800 patients in this study, and it did show a survival benefit of greater than 2 months. It's the first trial in non-small cell lung cancer to add an additional drug to existing chemotherapy that did show a survival advantage. That median survival was over 12 months, and that's the first time that's been demonstrated. The current trial that we are doing will enroll 50 patients. It is a very straightforward phase 2 study. Everybody gets drug. There's no randomization. And again, we are just looking to see that if we can achieve similar response rates, take a preliminary look at time to progression and survival, but also make sure that it's a safe combination.
And how many patients have been put on the study so far, and what have you seen?
We have four patients on the study right now. I myself has actually treated three others off study with Avastin with this combination, and we have not seen any adverse events. In fact, the first person I put on the combination of carboplatin, taxotere, and Avastin has completed six cycles of that therapy and now 5 months of maintenance of Avastin as well.
It's kind of interesting. This whole issue always comes out in oncology about how much research do you need in order to trigger a change in practice? Do we have to test everything that you see with one taxane with another? What are your thoughts about that?
I think those questions are not as practical necessarily for the practicing oncologist. I think that there are many drugs that are very good in lung cancer. I think where people want to see new research is novel combinations with biologic agents and more experimental agents. I think at the end of the day, everybody is happier if we have more drugs to choose from at the end rather than less.
When you look at combining bevacizumab with a taxane, and I guess you could include nanoparticle paclitaxel also, what do we know right now about safety and efficacy, not just in lung cancer, but other cancers, and looking at different taxanes with bevacizumab?
Well, currently, to my own knowledge, taxotere and paclitaxel are the only combinations that exist out there with Avastin. There will be a gemcitabine with cisplatin data by the end of the year. We're not sure if there's going to be any carboplatin with gemcitabine data yet, although I'm sure that trial is planned. And I'm unsure of any of the Abraxane studies, whether they are ready to use Avastin. I'm sure they are planning some.
Any reason to think theoretically or based on laboratory models that any one of these would be better than the other?
You know, we use a lot of synergistic models in lung cancer. Some of the data we get in cell lines are additive, and then they turn out synergistic in the clinic, and vice versa, which is actually more of the case where we see synergistic qualities within the lab, and then we don't see those same qualities in the human. So it's very variable from that standpoint. If you believe that Avastin is helping to synergize with the chemotherapy, enhance the chemotherapy effects, then theoretically, most chemotherapies that you combine with it should have an increased efficacy.
And I know that even before the Avastin trial was presented at ASCO last year, there was a press release even before that, you were generally using carbo and docetaxel outside of a clinical trial in first-line setting as opposed to paclitaxel. What was your thinking behind that?
Well, taxotere is one of the few drugs you can actually dose at the full prescribed dose of 75 per meter squared. Most people, when they prescribe paclitaxel, which is actually only FDA approved in non-small cell as the 24-hour infusion. Most people will use the 3-hour infusion, and I don't think you're wrong for doing that, but 225 is the number that's supposed to be what's used with 3-hour. We actually end up in practice using paclitaxel more at 175 per meter squared. Now, that's tolerable to the patient, and most people do very well with that regimen. However, the equivalent dose of Taxotere, if you compare it to a 175 per meter squared Taxol dose, is about 50. I think Avastin represents the VEGF class that is now going to be established in non-small cell lung cancer. You brought up several good points of taxanes, platinums, VEGF, and we will talk about EGF as well. These four classes of drugs have to be treated very equally now, just as in previous years it was platinums and taxanes.
Any other research you want to talk about that you're involved with?
Well, there are multiple different areas that are being looked at. Certainly, one study, we have a ZD6474 trial with Taxotere that is also called Zactima. That is a VEGF drug that is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, so not an antibody. They saw some very interesting results in the phase 2 study that was conducted. It was a randomized phase 2 study that Dr. John Hamak reported at ASCO last year. There is a phase 3 trial that is currently being launched across the nation with this combination in second line.
Do you do any laboratory work?
I collaborate with laboratory folks. I help put compounds in the lab as well as help design some experiments. Right now, I would say a very hot area is IGF. IGF, there are now some inhibitors of insulin-like growth factor out there, and we have a couple researchers, namely one at MD Anderson, Ho-Young Lee, who has been doing a lot of research with IGF and the pathway and how you can manipulate it using combinations with drugs such as Tarceva with EGF or even these previously tested farnesyl transferase inhibitors. And we've seen some very interesting preclinical results when you do combinations with those drugs.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the deliberations that have gone on within MD Anderson and also in the SWOG Lung Committee about strategically what we're looking at now in lung cancer clinical research over the next 5 or 10 years?
Right now, we've had a multiple sort of number of trials that have come and gone, testing chemotherapy with several biologic agents. Luckily, one emerged to be positive, and that was the Avastin. So now we're looking at combining pathways. One study that we are continuing to look at, and actually myself and Dr. Herbst are working on right now, is a combination of chemotherapy frontline with Avastin and Erbitux. And so trying to combine an EGF and a VEGF inhibitor with chemotherapy to further see if we can add to the blockade. Now, those types of trials are only going to get you so far. The fundamental change that has to happen within the lung cancer community, and it is happening within the cooperative groups, it's happening within the companies, is that we have to get tissue. In order to get tissue, we've got to be very, very good about getting large pieces of tissue, core biopsies, not only to just make the proper diagnosis on a patient, but also then we now have archived tissue in which we can test markers. Now we'll be able to see why is it someone responded well to Tarceva? Why did someone respond well to a taxane such as Taxotere? I have a patient personally who was treated with initial brain mets upon presentation, is a heavy smoker, it's a female, and we treated her with carboplatin and Taxotere over 3 years ago. She's not had any drop of therapy since November of 2002. So something in her tumor was exquisitely sensitive to one of those drugs, either carboplatin or Taxotere.
She's still in treatment?
She's not been treated for 3 years.
So how long was she actually treated?
6 months.
So she was treated for 6 months. Can you talk a little more about this interesting case? What happened?
Yeah, so her initial presentation was a brain herniation with a very large mass in her left lobe.
How old is she?
She was about 52 years old at the time. And she presented with a very bad headache, came to the emergency room. They did an MRI. This was in April of 2002, and they saw a very large mass. There was also another mass on the contralateral side of the brain that was smaller but still present. So after completing the surgery, which had to be done or she would have died, they found a lung mass in her chest, and it was adenocarcinoma.
And the other brain met was still in place?
The other brain met was treated with a stereotactic procedure. And so I staged her after all of this dust settled down, and we did not find any other disease other than the lung and then her previous brain disease. So we treated her with 6 cycles of chemotherapy with carboplatin and docetaxel. She had a very nice response to the therapy and completed therapy, her 6th cycle, in November of 2002.
Partial or complete response?
Partial. And I would say it's a very good partial, probably an 80% response. And since that time, I have followed her closely, and she has had no signs of recurrence since that time.
And the tumor's still sitting there, not growing?
A little sliver of something there in the chest, a little sliver of something in the brain.
Did the brain thing get smaller?
They were completed therapies up there, so there was just a little artifact, and hard to say if that was tumor or not.
So the question is, why is her tumor different than other tumors? Can we see something under microscope or genomic assay, a proteomic assay? What do you think are some of the markers maybe that would be interesting to look at for a patient like this and other kinds of markers?
It's related to what you brought up before about the direction of how we're going to treat patients. We are actually planning at MD Anderson in cooperation with Dana-Farber and Emory to do a series of phase 2 trials. And what we will do, we will mandate these patients who are second-line lung cancer patients to have a biopsy. They will get 2 core biopsies. After completing that biopsy, we are asking them to wait for 2 weeks. At that point, we will run a litany of biomarker tests, including VEGF-related, EGF-related, including mutation and amplification, other ones such as cyclin D1, RAS-RAF kinase. We are going to put all of this data into a statistical model that's being developed by one of our top statisticians, Dr. Jack Lee at MD Anderson, and come out with a hypothetical score. If the patient's tumor, we believe, based on preclinical data, favors a VEGF type of inhibition, that patient will then be randomized to a VEGF trial we have open. And 2 of them, which we will have, the 4 drugs we will be testing is Tarceva, Zactima, which is the ZD6474, Tarceva plus Bexarotene, because we've seen synergistic activities there, and this has been described at Dartmouth as well, and then finally Sorafenib as the final arm. And so based on the characteristics of this patient's tissue, we will hypothetically try to place them in a drug arm that is most favorable to their tumor. What is the best and worst case scenario? The best case scenario is that we get much higher response rates and disease control than has been described in other phase 2 studies. The worst case scenario is that we've randomly placed a patient into one of 4 very active drugs for non-small cell lung cancer. So it's a win-win from that standpoint.
I'm curious, given the recent history of the EGFR mutation related to TK inhibitors and IHC and FISH for EGFR, what are some of the things that you're going to look at to try to predict the response to erlotinib?
So we are going to look at EGFR mutations. We will also look at FISH amplification. We'll also look at RAS mutations as well. And the way we've developed the scheme, and what's very nice about this statistical model is that as we get more and more data that comes out about markers, it may shift the weight that we placed on each of these different markers. If we were designing this trial 2 years ago, or even 1.5 years ago, the mutation patients would exclusively go to one of the Tarceva arms. There would be no amplification. Now, a mutation doesn't carry as much weight necessarily as an amplification. They complement each other. But if you have a RAS mutation, no amplification, and an EGF mutation, perhaps that patient should not go on to an EGFR drug at this time, based on the limited data we have of RAS mutation patients perhaps doing a little worse with EGF-based drugs. But again, that is very preliminary.
This strategy you're describing sounds exactly like what's happening in breast cancer, particularly look at the NSABP and their neoadjuvant studies, where, of course, it's a lot easier to get tissue than with lung cancer. What are you going to say to patients about this, and how much extra you think morbidity or risk will there be in getting more tissue?
So there's always a risk anytime you do a procedure on a patient. What we will tell patients is just that. In breast cancer, they have made major strides because they are able to get tissue and do validated arrays, just as you say. The problem we have in lung cancer is we have no validation of arrays because we frankly don't have that much tissue to test in these metastatic patients. And so we will tell patients that they will have an opportunity to get one of these 4 very promising drugs, be followed very closely, and in fact, if they progress on one of these arms, we will retest their tissue, if they allow us to, and see if they may fit into a different arm, therefore having access to both EGF, VEGF, some of the more novel drugs that are available.
And if the patient says to you, how much extra risk am I going to take? How many extra procedures, and what are the risks of those procedures?
Mm-hmm. The only risk that they incur on this is doing either some sort of core biopsy. That may be a bronchoscopy. It may be a CT-guided core biopsy. The risks that we have described as particularly our center for doing these in lesions that are pretty reasonable, greater than 1 centimeter, somewhat peripheral, the risks that we have as far as pneumothorax or lung collapse are very low, more so in the realm of 1%.
That's exciting.
We are only able to do it because we have a very large grant from the Department of Defense. This is not something that's being sponsored by any other entity. There are some company-sponsored trials that are looking to get tissue and screen patients whether they have certain EGF markers. But we are trying to take a very broad-based approach to keep everything on the table and see if we can find some other predictive markers for various classes of agents. And yes, we are very excited about it. Myself, Dr. Herbst, Lee Mao, one of our scientists, and certainly Dr. Wan Ki-hong and Fadlo Curry are all involved heavily with this project.
I want to track back to something you said before, and then we kind of got off into this thing, but did you say that you and Roy Herbst were looking at a study of chemo with Erbitux and bevacizumab?
Correct.
Can you summarize a little bit about what we know about the impact of Erbitux and non-small cell?
The impact has been very promising phase 2 data in non-small cell. Combination with Taxotere in second line, which has now led us to a registration trial as a phase 3, and that is the Taxotere, Erbitux, Alimta, Erbitux, and the other two arms are just Taxotere or Alimta. And so that is a 4-arm randomized trial to assess the additional benefit, possibly, of the Erbitux with the chemotherapy. There is also a phase 3 frontline trial that's being done with Erbitux. It was based on Rozelle's report a couple years ago showing that combining it with chemotherapy, and this was platinum and vinorelbine, with or without Erbitux, showed some trends in a randomized phase 2 study that there may be some benefit. And so that is currently being tested as well in a phase 3 effort. There are also studies being done with chemotherapy and radiation, carboplatin and paclitaxel, in the stage 3 patient. And if that data looks promising, not only promising but also not as toxic as we hope, there will be an RTOG effort to launch a phase 3 study, but currently it's too preliminary to say that that's going to happen yet.
Is there single agent activity reported with Erbitux?
Single agent activity has been reported in lung. They have described, I believe it was about a 10% response rate in lung cancer. I believe it was Tom Lynch's abstract that was reported at ASCO within the last couple of years.
And any tissue predictors of response?
In the colon data, they have looked at overexpression, and there seems to be a trend in that direction. In lung, we have not seen that overexpression necessarily helps you with survival necessarily or response to Erbitux. When we looked at our own preliminary data with the Taxotere and the Erbitux in second-line lung, we didn't see overexpression status, and all these patients had to have overexpression of EGFR to be on this trial. We did not see any survival impact with overexpression status. However, we did see survival trends with grade of rash expression. As you had a worse rash, you actually had a better survival.
Can you talk more specifically about the chemo and the design of the study?
It is an evolution in process, and the reason it is because it's based on a study that's currently being completed in the SWOG that uses chemotherapy followed by Erbitux in a sequential manner, or chemotherapy given with Erbitux concurrently. Whichever one of those arms comes out superior, or if any, may depend on how we dose the Erbitux in this study.
He also has reported on erlotinib and bevacizumab. I hate to even say this, but what about all three of them together? Has anybody thought about that or thinking about doing that?
We might get slapped by the Medicare and, funding communities there for a trial like that. Yes, we with Vanderbilt reported a study of Avastin with Tarceva. It was a very nice combination. We did see some very interesting preliminary activity in very refractory non-small cell lung cancer patients. There have also been studies in head and neck cancer by the University of Chicago group that showed some interesting results. When you can propose a non-chemotherapy combination to a patient, they get very excited about that.
What is the chemotherapy that's being studied in the, was it the ECOG or SWOG, the Erbitux?
It's carboplatin and paclitaxel.
Okay, great. Would there be any interest in looking at three not biologics together?
I'm sure there's interest, and I'm sure there are proposals coming down the road. It's just going to be, at what point do we stop stacking all the drugs together? Because mTOR inhibitors are coming, sorafenib is now approved, so you will see many more trials with sorafenib. We have a Velcade with Avastin trial that's being proposed as well and has actually been accepted and is being written. You have to figure out at some point, when do we stop treating these biologic drugs like chemotherapies? We went through the whole thing with doublets versus singlets, triplets versus doublets, sequencing one or the other, and really get down to the tissue and figure out the biology as to why.
I guess the problem is, how long is it going to take for us to find those kinds of markers, even with something like bevacizumab? I haven't heard about anything that sounds all that promising, have you?
The VEGF pathway is a bit more nebulous as far as mechanism and finding validated markers. There are some folks, and John Haymack in our group is looking at circulating endothelial cells to see if those may predict VEGF responsiveness, but a lot of that work is, just as you say, very preliminary.
I want to get back to the ECOG 4599 study looking at bevacizumab. Have there been any more data made available from that trial?
There haven't been any formal updates presented as of yet. I know the paper is actually very much in the near end stages, and so we will probably see that manuscript appear soon. The filing for it, though, is a little bit down the road as they're still trying to gather all of the necessary information for the filing. As far as safety, we would have heard something by now if we had seen another safety or toxicity alert within the study.
I know one thing that was going to be looked at was to try to tease out who are the patients who have these hemorrhages, what is actually going on with those kinds of patients, the issue of, is it histology or location, anything more on that?
We haven't heard anything that location necessarily has to do it as much. Many of the trials that are being designed, and there are many being designed and ready to be implemented, including in patients with treated brain metastases, as well as squamous histology, these are two trials that are already planned to go and open nationwide. So we are becoming less fearful, per se, of the risk of brain bleeding. There wasn't a huge signal in the trial. There's also not been really many documented cases where patients with brain metastases have a higher propensity to bleed due to these VEGF compounds. In fact, Avastin has been studied in primary brain tumors such as glioma as well. So I think people's fears on that have calmed down a bit. As far as the squamous histology, that will continue to be sort of our main outlier of patients that we're trying to see that would benefit with Avastin. There will be studies testing these folks to see if the squamous cell has any location aspects that may cause it to bleed. But there have been descriptions of patients who bled peripherally as well.
Getting back to the issue of where things are heading in terms of the next generation of trials, what about in the adjuvant setting, specifically the issue of bevacizumab as adjuvant therapy?
So there are studies being proposed, there are ECOG trials being proposed, and I believe that is the combination that they want to move forward with in adjuvant, is with the Avastin. There are some pros and cons to that. If you believe Avastin works well in the metastatic setting, that would be a rationalization to move your best metastatic regimen as an adjuvant therapy. If you go with the data these days that's published, cisvinorelbine would be what you choose, but not many people are using cisvinorelbine as an adjuvant therapy. Myself, I use a lot of cisplatin and docetaxel as adjuvant, and we have a trial open at MD Anderson that uses adjuvant cisplatin and taxotere followed by 1 year of Tarceva. It is a pilot feasibility trial. We are going to look for some biomarkers, but it is not going to be a trial that's going to establish the use of maintenance Tarceva in this population of stage 1 through 3A. OSI, however, is working on a trial like that and will propose a trial and probably launch a trial next year, a large-scale trial that does use Tarceva as an adjuvant therapy. With Avastin, you think about what the problems could be in a post-operative setting, and we have to derive that from colon. Wound dehiscence was definitely something that occurred, as well as bowel perforation, in the early studies with Avastin and colon. You wonder if there will be any dehiscence aspects in lung cancer patients who have had surgeries that quickly, and we're not sure.
I know about the bowel perforations, but I've not heard about wound dehiscence.
There was a little bit of that described as well, and sometimes at first the thought was that all of these bowel perforations were coming from the actual surgical region, and then they found out there were actually independent areas within the bowel that had perforations and not necessarily at the actual surgical site.
So right now, I think in colon, the going approach usually I think is 6 weeks roughly, and I think that's kind of come out with your colleagues there at MD Anderson, Lee Ellis, et cetera, for using Avastin after surgery. Is that sort of what's being thought about with lung?
I don't know the exact date or timeline they're going to use with lung at this point. Certainly, we don't have any problem starting chemotherapy, which would reduce your blood counts and platelet counts during that period of time. So I think it would be very reasonable to do that.
Where are things heading in terms of clinical research in stage 3 disease?
Stage 3 is probably the most gray area of disease, and I believe when you state stage 3, you're denoting the patient that is not the one that is upfront surgically resectable. These are the patients that are either borderline resectable or, in fact, may be unresectable, in which we use concurrent chemotherapy and radiation strategies. So the problem in that population is going to be testing those folks with new biologic agents and trying to discern the toxicities that may be added with those biologic agents. As you know, patients who receive concurrent chemoradiation do suffer many more side effects than any other subgroup within lung cancer, and that's because the primary therapy is more toxic. When you add in a drug that targets EGF such as Erbitux or Tarceva, or even add in a drug like Avastin, you will get grade 3-4 toxicities in these patients, and then it will trigger stoppages of the trial to discern whether it was actually drug-related or not. I think these are all very good strategies, and certainly these drugs have demonstrated radiosensitizing effects in the lab. We're going to have Erbitux approved imminently for head and neck cancer, maybe actually with cisplatin as well, with radiation in head and neck cancer. There's no reason not to try to explore it further in lung cancer as well.
What's the chemotherapy backbone that people are talking about using, combining with these biologics?
So another very good question. It is very unclear. We have not been good in lung cancer of discerning the trees, the individual drugs which work the best. We have discerned the forest. The forest is combining chemotherapy and radiation is the best way to go. So there are multiple regimens that are out there. Anything from the most basic being a weekly platinum and a taxane, and that would either be carboplatin or cisplatin, Taxotere or Taxol. Another very popular regimen that's out there is the SWOG 9504 study, which used cisplatin and etoposide. The cisplatin was given on a day 1, 8, 29, and 36 regimen, the etoposide given on a day 1 through 5, as well as 29 through 33. That regimen had a 5-year survival of 29% in a stage 3B population, with the caveat that it was only a phase 2 study. So many of these regimens are being tossed around. I believe a lot of the early trials that are being considered with these biologic agents will use weekly platinum taxanes in their studies.
Another related issue, I guess, is the question of sort of the maintenance, or you could maybe even look at it as kind of an adjuvant in terms of the docetaxel that's given in that SWOG approach. What are your thoughts about that sort of strategically and clinically? How does that play out in your practice?
Yeah, so what was very unique about that SWOG approach was not only giving the higher doses of the chemotherapy and making them tolerable, but after completion of the concurrent chemoradiation, to give 3 cycles of full dose docetaxel. Now, some people will say that that's a consolidation method. I think it's a principle of adjuvant. You're giving adjuvant therapy, again, to a curative intent population. So I believe that that is a sound strategy. Whether you need a doublet or a singlet there really depends on how well the patient's going to tolerate your primary therapy. Certainly it's not for everyone, just like in surgery, where not everybody gets to take adjuvant chemo, whether that would be because they did not tolerate the surgery well or they had a very minimal tumor burden. So I think that strategy is sound. It is not tested yet in a phase 3 study. The Hoosier Oncology Group will test this study, and it will be reported probably in the next year or two about the adjuvant docetaxel given after the chemoradiation. I believe that that strategy works. that we need to build off of that type of strategy of giving an adjuvant chemotherapy such as Taxotere and then moving forward with giving some maintenance therapy. If you look at those stage 3 unresectables, they behave very much like many of our head and neck cancer patients who get concurrent chemoradiation. Their risk of having recurrence or new disease is very high. That is our highest risk population. And so that is an area we really need to focus on, as you say, maintenance therapy, some chemopreventive therapy after they've finished their chemotherapy and radiation.
How do you find patients tolerating the 75 per meter squared maintenance? Do you use growth factors?
After radiation, and we don't like to use growth factors so much with radiation, but after radiation, usually the first couple cycles of 75 per meter squared of Taxotere are tolerated well. Patients do get tired, and they are certainly in a very tired state after getting concurrent chemoradiation. The third cycle gets a little bit more difficult, and you do use growth factors if needed, both for hemoglobin or for white blood cell count.
I'm curious what your clinical experience has been now utilizing bevacizumab in the patients that you've treated. Any responses that maybe seem like more than you might have expected with chemo alone?
It's always very hard to say up front when you have a very limited number of patients you're treating. One of the stories I will hear from folks is when Tarceva was first approved, they'll treat 5 people and not see a response. And you have to remind them that, in fact, in the clinical trial, the phase 3 trial, the response rate was 8%. And so if you treat 100 patients, you'll see 8 responses. In lung cancer with chemotherapy, the highest chemotherapy response rate described in a phase 3 study was cisplatin and Taxotere at 32%. And so, again, 30 out of 100 will have responses. The few number of patients I've treated with Avastin and chemotherapy in first line, I have been impressed. They have all responded very well. And in fact, the first patient, as I had stated earlier, has now been on Avastin for 5 months with his tumor greatly shrunk down. He continues to have a little bit of shrinkage even the last time I saw him on maintenance Avastin. And this is a gentleman who presented with extremely bulky mediastinal lymph nodes, a primary tumor in the right lung, and a very large pleural effusion in the right lung. We did a thoracentesis and then a pleurodesis procedure on him, which he was admitted to the hospital for about 5 days to complete. We then started his chemotherapy with Avastin. We've had no issues of bleeding in him, and he's actually had a very, very nice response.
What about smoking status in terms of altering your algorithm for approaching therapy? First, in terms of the pure non-smoker, and also maybe the, I guess you'd call it, oligo-smoker, who's had very little exposure maybe in the past. Do you approach those patients any differently?
I think the only different approach we take for someone in the metastatic setting or even in the locally advanced setting is if they fit the phenotypic criteria of an Asian female non-smoker adenocarcinoma. We don't necessarily do it each time, but we definitely consider treating them with a TKI such as Tarceva. And just because of all of the reports that this favorable subgroup of patients seem to have high response rates to these drugs. When you think about a neoadjuvant approach, if you had that patient, a female, Asian, non-smoker with adenocarcinoma, and your only goal in a neoadjuvant approach is to shrink the tumor, would you use chemotherapy? Would you use a biologic like Tarceva? Or would you use them combined? It's a very open debate right now. And again, we're not talking survival here. We're just talking about trying to downstage the tumor. Maybe you would want to use something like Tarceva. It's a very open-ended question at this point.
And how much do we know about the difference between a non-smoker and, you know, sort of an oligo smoker?
Not much. And the reason is, and I get a little pessimistic when I see this data being presented, is because we don't keep very good smoking histories on patients. When we conduct chemo prevention trials, there are at least 10 questions on smoking. How many packs did you smoke? When did you start? When did you stop? Did you smoke 2 packs a year at some point versus 1 pack a day? These are the different aspects we try to measure. Do your parents smoke? Did you grow up in a household with smoke? Do you work in a factory? Does your spouse smoke? Nobody asks any of these questions. And clearly, if your parents smoked when you were growing up, you were in a car with smoke many times, that has to constitute some sort of exposure.
You know, your patient who's now been on single-agent bevacizumab for 5 months after getting the chemo bevacizumab brings up a number of research issues. Actually, it reminds me a lot of trastuzumab and breast cancer. First, the question of what are you going to do if and when he progresses in terms of the bevacizumab?
That's a great question, too. The patient is in great performance status. I just saw him about 2 months ago. He's going to come again next month. He is on maintenance Avastin at this point because he's had a wonderful response to the carboplatin taxotere and Avastin therapy. If he were to progress the next time I see him, I would consider two strategies. One would be to add Tarceva to the Avastin and use that as my second-line treatment. The other strategy is that if he's had a prolonged period of disease stabilization on Avastin after completing the chemotherapy, i.e. more than 6 months, I may consider retreating him with the same chemotherapy and Avastin because he demonstrated previous sensitivity. Those would be the things that would be going through my mind.
What about, let's say you do that and he responds and progresses again, the concept of continuing bevacizumab and adding a different chemotherapy?
Absolutely. And you alluded to that with the breast cancer with trastuzumab. I think right now that's what people are thinking, is that perhaps Avastin has those similar type of properties where it's an enhancer of another therapy, and in fact that may be the right strategy. We don't know that based on any clinical trials, but certainly it's something we're extrapolating.
Is that something you'd consider doing in a non-protocol setting? And in a patient who got, for example, carbo and docetaxel like your patient, what would be the chemo you might add?
Because the Tarceva and the Avastin data look good, I like to go with that first. If that were to fail, I would consider putting a drug like Alimta with Avastin. There will be a trial open that tests the feasibility of those combinations, but that's certainly something that could be done.
I guess in the interest of presenting different points of view, we should say that there are a lot of people who would probably jump off the table hearing you say what you just said. We can't do this until we get the randomized trials. We can't fall into the same trap we had with trastuzumab, but yet we have to kind of make the best decision we can, and there's cost issues too.
I would totally agree, and what I'm saying here is merely just an opinion. We don't have any facts in this setting for lung cancer, and I've actually pleasantly found that some of the private community doctors out there are doing more cavalier things with these agents, and I applaud that. I think as long as there's some safety data that exists out there, if you're trying to treat your patient on their best behalf, and this is really what you think is the right thing to do, I think in lung cancer, we do have quite a bit of freedom to do that.
Yeah, it's really such a vexing issue in really all of oncology. And again, you hear more and more in terms of the issue of cost. And if these agents were extremely inexpensive, I don't know that we would be as sort of upset about people trying sort of different things. But, and I don't really know what the answer is about the cost thing. What are your thoughts on that?
The cost issue comes up every time. We have to respect how much money we are spending. But chemotherapy also has a lot of cost as well. And drugs like Iressa and Tarceva were picked on because they were oral pills and they did cost quite a bit. But when you compare 1 month of treatment with a drug such as Tarceva versus 1 month of treatment with a chemotherapy, you're actually ahead. Now, when you get into the antibody spectrum, where they are intravenous and they are given the manner that they are, that is a very high cost. So I believe people want more demonstrated activity in phase 3 studies before they start making that leap of faith to do combinations, etc. But it is very encouraging what we're seeing with drugs like rituximab, with trastuzumab, now with Avastin and Erbitux. And so the antibody subset of drug development seems to be a very promising one.
It's interesting, too, when I interview investigators outside the United States in many different tumors, how different their responses are because they're so much more restricted in terms of what they can do.
That's absolutely correct. The amount of drugs that we have available here in the United States, we are clearly spoiled compared to the rest of the world. Many of these countries don't even have a drug like Tarceva approved, and it may be years before they get a drug like Avastin even approved through their agencies. There is a high emphasis for cost and cost-benefit in these areas. But then again, if we had such a pessimistic outlook for lung cancer, we would not be even treating these folks with chemotherapy, because 2 months of benefit with chemotherapy at one point in this country was deemed not acceptable. When we finally did demonstrate that people had improved quality of life and clinical benefit with chemotherapy, the culture changed.
Yeah, and hopefully, I mean, all those countries, many of them will pay for example, adjuvant trastuzumab or rituximab. So I guess it's just a question of how much evidence you need before you're willing to make a national commitment to invest dollars in it.
And we even have the same problem in certain public arenas in the United States. Not all of our public hospital patients have access to these drugs either. And we do see them, and we do have more limited choices there. So there are some tough choices being made even in our own county hospitals in the United States. I want to remain very optimistic about lung cancer research. I think it's exciting that people are talking about it. We weren't talking about it so much 10 years ago. I think the direction is moving in the right direction as far as now focusing on tissue. And I think overall, patients are living longer. They're benefiting from these drugs. And it's nice to be able to have a conversation with a lung cancer patient and tell them there are choices on the table as far as therapies, both cytotoxic and biologic.
Yeah, it is great to see, you know, lung cancer, colon cancer, diseases that were kind of boring when you were a fellow in the past to even hear about be so exciting. But I guess one thing I wonder a little about in terms of lung cancer is whether the lung cancer community is going to be able to accrue to large trials quickly enough to get some answers, particularly adjuvant trials. I'm not sure the track record, particularly in North America and the United States, is all that great in that regard.
That's a great point. Another of the next steps we have to do is we have to be more collaborative as a whole. The NSABP, what they can accomplish in breast cancer is amazing to me. We have to be able to accrue to 4,000 or 5,000 patient trials in lung cancer. We certainly have the patients. We just have to get everybody together more into an intergroup type setting and decide what our priorities are and what we want to answer.
Do you think that's going to happen?
I think it will be forced to happen, because we do want to ask now questions in more curative populations. If you want to ask important questions in curative populations, the size of those studies has to increase several fold.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Lung Cancer Update.